Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
I think it's extremely important because it gives kids a chance to stand on their own two feet, do their own research and investigate areas they're interested in themselves.
I made my annual trip to the BT Young Scientist exhibition to look at some of the projects that looked into education topics. I'll bring you my report from the RDS. But first we go to Barry Hennessy for his weekly look into matters that are of interest to educators. You're welcome, Barry.
Hello again, Sean. There's been a lot of talk about the work of guidance counsellors in the aftermath of the announcement in the budget that each school will now have to provide for guidance from within its normal initial teacher allocation. Guidance counsellors have leapt to the defence of their role in providing a range of support to pupils, but there have also been suggestions that some principals feel there's a lack of clarity regarding the role that the counsellors perform. Well, Bernie Burke is a guidance counsellor at the Donaghy's Community School in Dublin 13, and she's here to hopefully shed some light on just how guidance counsellors occupy their days. You're welcome, Bernie.
Thanks very much, Barry.
Guidance or career guidance?
Well, it's both. You know, it's guidance and career guidance. It covers what's called guidance is career guidance and counselling, and it covers personal, educational, vocational guidance and social guidance. So the guidance counsellor has a very large spectrum of topics to cover with students, and it's a hugely vital role in the school. Now, I'm only in guidance and counselling in the last few years, so I would have taught in the same school for years and was always aware of the important function of the guidance counsellor. And when I made the decision to do extra study, obviously I was aware that this was something I wanted to contribute towards because it was so important and vital. And like all guidance counsellors, I'm in a state of shock, to be honest, since the budget announcements.
Have you seen a change in your role over the years you've been in guidance? I mentioned the career guidance for the simple reason that there will be, I suppose, a generation of people out there for whom that'll have been their interaction with the guidance counsellor. Has it changed?
Well, the counselling part of it, I suppose, is probably more important now than it was maybe when I was in school. But the guidance counsellor was always supposed to be available to the students for any personal issues. It's just that in the training, it's a very important element of the training. Counselling skills are taught, group counselling and individual counselling skills. And the people who come out of college having done a master's or a postgrad in guidance and counselling are trained to deal with the issues that are facing young people in Ireland today.
Mm-hmm. Now, students go to the guidance counsellor in confidence. I mean, it's somebody that they can go to. The meetings are usually one-to-one. That's the nature of the thing. But could you give us a kind of a general overview of the type of situations or cases that you might be confronted with across the average school day?
Well, across the average school day, I suppose the confidential aspect of it is the reason why people do not understand the role. But students could come with a range of issues like stress, depression, family problems, suicide ideation, pregnancy, neglect. The range is just, it's never ending, and especially in a school like in a DESH school where I would work, obviously socioeconomic problems, there will be more issues arising for the guidance counsellor.
Mm-hmm. Which year groups? I mean, is it possible to be specific as regards to the year groups within the school that tend to require most attention from the guidance service?
The Education Act 1998 states that there has to be appropriate guidance for all students. But of course, it does vary. Now, in our school, for instance, we have extra guidance hours through the Guidance Enhancement Initiative, which is a DESH initiative. And we would have then senior and junior guidance. So there's a huge need at the junior level for personal and social guidance, for subject choice guidance, for just general psychometric testing and stuff like that. Now, I'm dealing with seniors mainly at the moment. And at the moment, the emphasis is on CAO and college applications. So it might be balanced a little bit towards career at the moment, but that wouldn't be the year long. It would be much more balanced in terms of counselling and career guidance on the overall year. But at the moment, I would be dealing with students in their applications for college. And to be honest with you, they do need a lot of help. And it's a very time consuming process. They need more so than ever guidance to choose the right courses so that they won't be dropping out of courses that they had no idea about. Really, it's a time-consuming process.
Because obviously even areas like subject choice, for example, you know, students have to, I suppose, know the way in which subjects relate to the CAO choices they might have later, the subjects you can't drop.
That happens in third year and in fourth year when we're preparing them for their subject choices for fifth year. So that's hugely important, and that would be a kind of a joint exercise between the two, in our school, between the two guidance counsellors, junior and senior, when we're merging the two groups, the juniors going towards senior level. moving from third to fifth or fourth.
Let me just bring you back to that remark that was passed by one or two informed education observers who suggested that the budget measure with regard to guidance, that there might be, how would I put this, that there might be a feeling among some principals out there that they don't really know what guidance counsellors are doing. Would you regard any comment in that direction as fair?
Well, guides, we are an isolated in that we work alone, but we only work alone like with students. That's the confidential issue. And then after that, you're working with the whole care team within the school. You're working with the tutors and the year heads and the homeschool liaison officer. You're working with the resource team, the chaplain. So there is a care team that work together and we bounce things around. So you're not completely isolated. The principal really should be very aware of in a school of what's going on in guidance. It's possible that some principals do not know what the guidance counsellors are doing, but really they ought to. I mean, the counselling end of it is confidential and that must be kept that way. But everything else that the guidance counsellor does is done in conjunction and liaison with the principal. The principal has a copy of the guidance plan and should and liaise with the guidance counsellor regularly, as would happen in our own school, about what are the needs of the students for that particular year. Whether it be psychometric testing, whether it be CAO talks, whether it be parent evenings, whatever the case may be, the principal should be working, and in a lot of cases definitely would be working in conjunction with the guidance counsellor.
Who else do guidance counsellors have to liaise with apart from, say, local management? What are the range of bodies inside or outside that you would have to liaise with in terms of the issues that students would present you with?
Yeah, very often a student will present with an issue that is beyond your power to deal with, and counsellors will be very aware of that, that the training they have will prepare you for so much, but that there are issues which are specific that we would refer on for. So you'd be dealing with the HSE, Family and Child Services. You'd be dealing with PA to House, the ISPCC, Bernardus, any of these organisations, body-wise, that might be involved with young people.
And presumably you have to be upfront with the young person when they come in to you as to the fact that there may be something that they will tell you that you won't be able to deal with and that you're going to have
It's in all counselling, that's the first thing you must always state is that it's a confidential zone, that everything you say will be kept in confidence unless you do suggest that you could harm yourself or another person, and then it would have to be moved on. So everybody coming into a counselling session would be aware of that, that they are protected. Everything is confidential unless they reveal something that's a danger to themselves or others.
All right, Bernie Burke, Guidance Counsellor at the Donaghy's Community School in Dublin 13. Thanks for coming into us.
And thank you for that, Barry. And Barry Hennessy will, of course, be back with another report next week. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. One event that I look forward to every year is my visit to the PT Young Scientist Exhibition in the RDS to find out about some of the studies related to school and schooling. This year, I spoke to several participants and their study topics were on project maths, a comparison of interactive video games and school books, and cramming. I also spoke to a teacher and a visiting politician. But I begin with a study that investigated project maths and asked, is it worth it? Aisling Lawson is a student in Hartstown Community College. I spoke to her and began by asking her, well, is it worth it?
Well, there's mixed views, but at the moment, and in my school, no. It's only achieved one of its five key aims, and it's the attitude towards it is very, very mixed, and mostly neutral or negative.
Okay, so how did you go about your study then?
So what I did was I gave surveys to students, all the maths teachers in the school, interviewed the maths teachers, and then I compared the difference between results from before starting Project Maths and after starting Project Maths. And then lastly, I compared higher level students with ordinary level students.
So what year did you study? In other words, how long had they been studying Project Maths?
I studied the fifth year, so they had done standard maths last year and they did Project Maths this year. So I studied them in December, so they'd finished a good chunk of their fifth year course by the time I did it.
And do you think that it might be too soon to see any effects of Project Maths yet?
I think that there are definite effects, but it's too soon to make a definitive, oh, it's not worth it, yes it is. At the moment, and at this present time, it isn't doing what it's supposed to, but there are still developments and teething problems that can be sorted out if the government takes action.
Can you tell me how you checked the students' learning of Project Maths before and after?
What I did was I compared their achievement. So I used their junior certificate results when they were studying the standard maths course with their Christmas exam results when they were studying the project maths course. So I had to take into consideration that the kind of the motivation levels would be different for a state exam and for a Christmas exam. So some drop in achievement was to be expected, but there was a very drastic drop. So.
And that wasn't just because they were studying a new programme, that the Leaving Certificate programme would naturally be more difficult than the Junior Cert?
No, I talked to several maths teachers and they agreed that the drop in the higher level students was kind of to be expected. The standard of maths expected was much greater, but in the ordinary level students there wasn't usually that much of a drop.
And you didn't just look at the change of achievement, you also looked at the change of attitude. What did you find there?
I found that the students were mostly neutral, if a bit negative, towards Project Maths, mainly because of the change in it. They were a bit uncertain as to what was going on. But then the teachers, I found that they were mostly neutral as an average, but the reason for this is they're kind of polar opposites. There were a lot of teachers on either end of the spectrum. Some teachers said, oh, it's great, it's much more relatable, everyone's getting it. And other teachers were kind of just like, oh, it's dumbing down maths, I don't want to teach like this. There were really varied opinions. There was no really curve in the graph.
And did you notice whether or not the children of the teachers who were more positive did better than the students of the teachers who were more negative?
I wasn't able to compare that because I'd have to make the questionnaires for the teachers. I'd have to take them away from being anonymous. I'd have to have the teacher names. And I didn't want to have the teacher names because there were a couple of questions about the teacher training courses. And I didn't want perhaps feelings of kind of guilt or uncertainty from the teachers about maybe not attending courses to affect their honesty on the questionnaires. So I wanted to be as accurate as possible.
And what kind of sample sizes were you talking about in terms of the children and in terms of the teachers?
Well, there were 18 maths teachers in the school, so each of those were interviewed twice and they were given questionnaires. Then the students, because I wanted to compare higher level and ordinary level, there are only two higher level classes in the school, in fifth year, I had two higher level classes and two ordinary level classes, so it's about a total of 77 students.
And what lessons then do you think the Project Maths, people implementing it, what lessons can they take from your study?
I think they can kind of lessen the emphasis on English in the study because there's a lot of international students and they would struggle greatly with that, whereas maths was usually something that could transfer between languages.
Do you mean the level of written, the amount of reading that people have to do in order to solve the maths problems?
Yeah, previously there would have been kind of a short sentence explaining things, but now there could be anything up to a paragraph about something. And in some cases, as opposed to writing out your equations, doing your formulae, there can be questions about like your opinion on how this data could be accurate or inaccurate and things like that. And that's very difficult for people coming from abroad to Ireland.
And why were you interested in this project?
I'm interested in this project because maths is a passion of mine. I love maths, but there's been dramatically decreasing kind of rates in achievement in Ireland like over the past while. It's just dropped drastically, and I wanted to see if Project Maths would do all it said it would. It's made up to be this great thing, but I wasn't so sure.
And are you studying Project Maths yourself?
I'm studying Project Maths at the moment, yeah.
And what's your own opinion?
It gets a bit wishy-washy. I like the intentions behind it are great, but I don't think it translates too well.
What does wishy-washy mean?
Wishy-washy. It's a bit up in the air. It's not very detailed. It's not very accurate. It's a bit all over the place.
But is that not the point? Is it not meant to get you thinking and to organise your own thoughts and ideas on maths in order to solve a problem?
It's meant to get you thinking, but it's not meant to get you thinking about every such situation that could possibly occur in random things. It's meant to be relatable. It's meant to make sense. It's not meant to just be Johnny was in space 20 years ago. Like, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's not really doing what it's supposed to say the least.
An Aisling's project was placed second in the intermediate individual category. Two students from Donabate Community College compared interactive video games and school books for their potential to help students learn school curriculum subjects. When I spoke to Greg Bauer and Ben Morris, I first asked them why they did this project.
We were inspired by another game to do this project because we just love games and we thought it would be really cool to learn a language or different subjects from it. Yeah, we were just thinking, like, oh, who wants to, like, read a book during class, you know? We'd prefer to use something fun, like playing the PlayStation, more or less. Like, it'd be good to go home and have your homework on the PlayStation, just sit down and play it, so...
Yeah. And to be learning as well.
Yeah, to be learning as well, like, so, yeah.
So how did you go about designing the study, then?
Well, we just drew out a sheet, like, of different words, and then the people in the room, there was 30 first years, and four people took controllers, and they played the game, and the other people, they looked at the screen and tried to get out the words from the little test that we put out.
And what did you find?
We found that actually people do find it easier to study by playing video games, because they're really concentrated on the game. Like, on the book, people do doze off, like, I kind of do, but, yeah, it was pretty good getting them in playing the PlayStation in Spanish. Like, they were learning really fast.
But they were only learning individual words, whereas a language is all about communication. Do you know if they were getting any better at communicating?
Yeah, because a lot of time when you're playing this game, you also, it's a very, like, multiplayer game, so you can play with other people, and you'll be talking and having fun with them. So it's a really good, like, social activity and, like, you know, building up your social confidence, like, by playing with other people and stuff.
So how did you test whether or not people were actually learning the language?
We use that test up there, and
now the people who are listening can't see that, so can you tell them what that test is all about?
The test is about 20 English words, and when people were playing the game, they were looking at the screen, and when they were looking at the screen, the words would come up, so they'd be kind of going, oh, okay, I know that word. They'd be putting it beside the English word. So we got about 90 students all together to do those tests, and it went really well.
And what did you find among those 90 students?
That the most that people did not answer was 5. Only people, like, they only left out 5 was the least. So it went really well, like.
And is that enough then to decide that teachers should get rid of the textbook and should start focusing on games to teach language?
Well, I don't think they should get rid of the books completely. Like, we really want to see, like, we really want to happen is that we can use a bit of the books and a bit of the video games, because it'd be really good to mix, and even the teachers were all up for it, and they were saying that's a great idea, so.
But there's going to be a cost implication. Who's going to pay for these games?
Hopefully our principal, because, yeah, she's the principal, so hopefully she'd support it and then pay for the PlayStation and stuff, you know.
Well, yeah, and, like, even ourselves, like, we, like, as you know, students spend at least, like, €150 on their school books, like, every year. So, like, and a game only costs, at most a game could cost €50, at least it could cost, like, €10. So, like, they're not that much compared to this overall school books.
What's even better is because with your school books you're carrying these really heavy bags. With games you're just carrying like 2 or 3 games, and it'll be really light, so it'll be a lot better for yourself.
And do you think that this might have any implications for subjects other than languages?
Yes, definitely. We have studied another game that inspired us, and that game is based on the Renaissance Italy, and you have like loads of information about it, like you learn about the Borgias and the Medici families, and meet historical figures such as Leonardo da Vinci and stuff like that, so it's really good.
And Ben and Greg were highly commended for their project. They're students at Dunabate Community College, and I also spoke to a teacher from that school, Lisa Curran, at the exhibition. I asked her how important the Young Scientist exhibition is for encouraging interest in science in schools.
I think it's extremely important because it gives kids a chance to stand on their own 2 feet, do their own research and investigate areas they're interested in themselves. And it does give them an interest to go on and pursue science then at senior level. It gives them the bug really to go on and pursue science. So I think it's very important.
And why do you think there has been some low achievement or some poor results in science in recent years and low uptake of science among students?
I can only speak from our own school now, where science is compulsory and our science results were fantastic. So I haven't had the experience of low uptake or poor results. But I think if kids are given the choice before, when they come into secondary school, they haven't experienced it properly in primary school. So their initial reaction from primary schoolers that it's too hard, they don't want to do it, it's not going to be interesting. So I think they need to be, it needs to be made compulsory in schools, I think. And if it's compulsory for junior cert, then it gives them a taste. And the majority of them take it up again in one of the three subjects at leaving cert.
And what do you put that down to then? Why? What is it about the teaching at post-primary science that encourages their interest and keeps their interest and raises their achievement?
I think it's a new course as well. They've got coursework B's, which is compulsory investigations themselves. It's all interactive teaching now. There is PowerPoint usage, there is videos, there's DVDs. YouTube is used a lot. So teachers have adjusted their teaching to meet the needs of the kids and what they're used to doing.
And do you think YouTube is taking away from doing live experiments in something like chemistry or physics?
No, you can't replace the actual doing the experiment in class, but it gives them a chance to see experiments that you couldn't perform in class. So you can do certain experiments in class, but now they have the ability to look at experiments that would not be performed. So it's very important. It enhances teaching.
And do you find a difference in the take-up between physics, chemistry and biology?
Not so much. Biology, from our own experience, is the most popular subject. But we had chemistry. We had two classes of chemistry this year. So our uptake is generally it's about the same.
And was it a difficult decision to decide to make science compulsory for students from the outset of their post-primary school experience?
No, it was just school policy that science was compulsory. So.
And that's been there all the time.
Yeah.
Among science teachers, when science teachers get talking together, what are the challenges that you find in teaching science?
Challenges just keep the kids interested and keep our teaching methods up to date with new technologies and keep them engaged, really. But at the end of the day, they still have to go home and learn their materials. So you can have as many fun classes as possible, but at the end of the day, the challenge is trying to get them to actually sit down and learn the material.
And that was Lisa Curran from Donabate Community College. I also bumped into a former teacher and Minister for Education at the exhibition. Micheál Martin is currently leader of Fianna Fáil, so I asked him why he took time from his schedule to visit the Young Scientist exhibition.
Well, I've been coming to Young Scientist exhibition since about 1997. I come every year. It's one of the best weeks of the year in terms of the country's future. I get a great sense of optimism when I come here and I leave it, because you just see hundreds, if not thousands, of young people with great ability, great confidence, with interesting projects, and one leaves with a great degree of confidence in the future capacity of the country and its people to come out of this crisis and to do well. And I just want to salute the young students who again have excelled themselves in being selected, which is a difficult challenge in itself, with the projects that they have. And it's a coincidence that I just met you now with one of my local schools in Ballyvihan and Cork Presentation Secondary, one of the best schools in the country for a number of things, for drama, theatre and for science. Well done to them. It's just great to be here.
And you have a teaching background yourself, Mr. Martin. Can you say how important is this for teachers and for education in general?
It's very important, because when you're teaching in the classroom, I think one always yearns to have a place where you can demonstrate what has been learned. And I think the modern curriculum has moved a lot to children and young people and students being more active in developing the curriculum itself and acting out the curriculum, if I use that phrase. And the Young Scientist Project is very much about the doing of it. And one of the issues we've had with science for quite a number of years is that there's been too much of a passive approach to science. There's been endeavours to change the curriculum to have the students, if you like, involved in more practical work, more assignments and more tasks-orientated approach. And a young scientist really fills the bill. And it's like saying, you know, if you're teaching music or you want people on stage eventually, or you want people performing, the same with drama. And the same applies to science. You want people out there experimenting, doing the surveys, interviewing, and learning the techniques, learning the disciplines, developing a team approach, a multidisciplinary approach to the subject matter. And this Young Scientist exhibition captures all of that. And I salute young girls here in particular for what they're doing. It's got to do with cramming, and I'll find out shortly what they believe, what their view on that is, you know.
The project that Micheál Martin was going to look at was by three students from the Presentation Secondary School in Ballybofahan in Cork. The title of the project was Cramming, and it was done by Eva Wallace, Elizabeth Foley-Landers and Sarah Shanahan. I asked Sarah to tell me what their project was about.
We decided to study the difference between cramming and regular study over a regular period of time. And so what we decided to do also was to see, was it effective as a study method, and to see its effects on the stress levels of students.
So what exactly do you mean by cramming?
Cramming is learning a large amount of material in a short amount of time, as opposed to studying, which is kind of learning the same amount of material but in an appropriate amount of time.
Okay, so how did you go about studying that question, Ava?
Well, we began by starting surveys amongst 5th-year, 6th-year students of both our school, Presentation of Belfihan, and Cuistri, which is a boys' school around the corner. We found that the majority of students do cram, and that we also learned the study habits of the students from the surveys. We then went on to continue to see the effects of mental health, the effects on mental health the study has, through yet again another survey of the senior cycle of our own school. We also then continued to do interviews with third level students, one student from UCC and one student from Stefan Efa, to see the difference between secondary school and third level education.
Okay, and can you tell me a little bit more about what you learned when you did the study?
We learned that really it's all down to the person themselves. If someone's good at a subject, they're going to be able to cram it all into a short period of time, and then they're going to do well in an exam. But that's not going to they're not going to be able to retain all that information. They're going to forget it fairly quickly. But if you're not as good at a subject, you're going to have to study regularly. You're going to have to work harder for it, because otherwise you won't be able to get it into a short period of time.
So it's not a black and white thing that cramming is bad and regular study is good.
No, because if you need, say, a small enough amount of information for tomorrow or 2 days' time, if you crammed it all into one go, you'd probably remember it. We did a test to check it ourselves. So we had two groups learning poetry, and one group was given it the night before, and the other group was given it a couple of minutes before they were asked to write it down. And the cramming groups did better both times we tried this. But we felt that was because the poems were so short, and that they kind of rhymed, and it was just much easier to learn off. So we felt that we might actually do a little better if maybe we gave them something longer to learn, or a longer period of time, just to get more conclusive information.
But that's quite interesting, even what kind of things are easier to learn than others. What did you find in your study?
We only gave them poems to learn, but we thought maybe if we gave them a math theorem or, some science facts or something, we might have gotten some different results.
What would your recommendations then be for students who are doing their Leaving Cert this year?
Well, everybody's different in the methods of studies which they use. Study aids such as acronyms, rhymes, keywords, and mind maps, all suited to different students, more for like a visual impact as opposed to just learning off by rote. Memory tips also include get plenty of sleep and exercise, and make time for friends and fun to minimise stress.
And that does sound like good advice for anyone doing their Leaving Certificate this year. That concludes my report from the Young Scientists Exhibition. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to all this week's guests and to my colleague Barry Hennessy. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.